Okay, so hello and welcome everyone. I'm showing that it's at 7:01, so we're going to go ahead and get started. I do have just a couple of announcements. Of course, this is our first night in the Gampa at the Kadampa Center on site, so it's very exciting. And so far, so good. I don't want to jinx us, though. This is our first class of Samsara and Nirvana, which is module number 9 of Discovering Buddhism. And Steep will be our instructor tonight. And as far as anything else goes, once you have registered for DB, you should have received an email with the information on how to access course materials. That information is already posted there, the information sheet. And then if you are interested in doing the homework assignments, homework will be posted there probably at some point later on tonight. And so I think that's all of the announcements I have. I didn't really have a lot. And of course, there is always lots and lots continuing to happen as we bring on more and more on-site opportunities. So keep an eye on the calendar, of course, at the website. And because as most of you know, that's my favorite place to go is the calendar. And I think Steep is ready. So I'm going to maybe turn it over to her in just a second. Yeah, are you ready? Okay, great.
All right, thanks. Oh boy, am I out of practice? All right, welcome everybody, and thank you for coming, and we're all guinea pigs today, so give us your feedback. Yeah, we have a very interesting module on samsara and nirvana. Who here is your very first time coming to the Kadampa Center? Well, welcome, welcome. And what Discovering Buddhism is a series of classes in these modules that kind of build on each other, but you can come in at any point because all the material kind of blends together. And feel free to stay and talk with people afterwards. And I'll also put my email up there so you can ask me questions during the week if you feel kind of confused or anything. There's a lot of people here. There's actually, we almost outnumber you all in terms of people from the center who can answer questions. So welcome. And some of you, you've been on this merry-go-round a couple of times, so you'll be great resources for people who are just stepping in. And so since this is the first class in the module on samsara and nirvana, the first class is kind of an introduction to what we're going to be doing. Linda's going to do some announcements, and then we're going to watch this really cool introductory video that is produced by the umbrella organization which we are under, which really will sum up the topic beautifully. And then we're cutting these classes really short as we kind of test things out. So after the video, we will dive into some of the material and then meet up next week. Keep on going. So I think I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Mm-hmm. One thing I did want to mention that I forgot to mention a moment ago is that if there are any technical glitches, if you can't see or hear or something is happening that is not right, just put that in the chat if you're on Zoom. And of course, if we're in the Gampa, hopefully I'll be aware of that. And if you're on YouTube, you can put it in the chat as well. And please do use the chat for any questions or comments that you might have. And that's for Zoom and or YouTube participants as well. So with that, I will go ahead and try to bring up our video that we're going to watch. So bear with me for just a moment.
Yeah. We normally think things exist the way they appear, that impermanent things are permanent, and that we can find happiness through trying to control the external world to satisfy our desires. It's a pretty bleak situation, and it's called samsara. Samsara is the agitated, dissatisfied, and confused state of mind most of us experience all the time, which results in the uncontrolled cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. Just as there is dark and light, if there is samsara, then there is nirvana. And that's the state of complete mental peace. Nirvana is not an external heaven or a paradise, but rather it's a state of mind. It's totally free of all limitations and no longer controlled by destructive emotions. Join us in looking more deeply at samsara and how we're caught in it, and nirvana and how we are liberated by it.
Samsara and nirvana. On the one hand, samsara or cyclic existence is suffering and its causes. On the other end of the spectrum, there's nirvana, complete freedom, complete liberation from that suffering and its causes. Our current situation is that we're in cyclic existence, in samsara, and where we want to go is nirvana, complete freedom. But there's no way that we can get there without an intention to do so, without a strong motivation. So before listening to the teachings, right now, generate a strong motivation in your own mind to learn as much as possible about both samsara, our current situation, and nirvana, where we want to go, in order to be able to achieve that freedom for the benefit of all sentient beings as quickly as possible.
I'd like to explain a little bit more about, to get a real idea of what samsara means, you know, the depth of samsara, so that one can begin to feel compassion for oneself and a feeling of what is the meaning of renunciation, you know, that the thought renouncing samsara. So we first have to know exactly what samsara means to generate this wish to overcome samsara. So samsara, what it really means. And there is one explanation that includes, we call, three levels, you know, of suffering. Three kinds of suffering. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to explain this first, yeah? The first one is called suffering of pain. And that includes all the ordinary pains, physical pains, sickness, hurt, and our mental problems of suffering of separation, you know, dissatisfaction, depression, anxiety, fear, worry. That's usually only that level of suffering that we are aware of, you know, in our daily life, that we are trying to overcome. But samsaric suffering has much more to it than that, you know. The second level of samsara we call the suffering of change. And the suffering of change is much more subtle and difficult to comprehend, you know. It's all about how the pleasures that we seek in samsara, the temporary pleasures, are in fact all in the nature of suffering, because they change into dissatisfaction and eventually pain. You know? So we say, although we called it pleasure, In fact, it's in the nature of suffering. Yeah, we give it the name pleasure, but somehow when we analyze it, we can see eventually always turns into suffering or misery, you know. The third kind of suffering that explains samsaric existence, you know, is the for all-pervading suffering, or pervasive suffering. Pervasive because it covers all of our existence, our body and our mind, you know, is in the nature of this all-pervasive suffering. So everything within our ordinary body and mind is a product, you know, of suffering, and creates more suffering. So it's in the nature of suffering. When we understand these levels of suffering, we can look at samsara and see the faults of samsaric existence. You know? That there is nothing within samsaric existence that gives us satisfaction or happiness or is uncontaminated. But if we meditate on it, we can start to develop disgust with samsaric suffering. Especially when we realize that we have the potential to be free. For Buddhists, samsara is but a way of looking at the world that is associated with attachment and self-cherishing and the desire that things be as we wish them to be. And since this whole notion of the world being as we wish it to be, since our wanting the world to remain a certain way cannot be met, is always subject to failure, because the true nature of the world is impermanence and changingness all the time, those desires to keep it permanent will inevitably lead to suffering. The Buddha taught Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. There is a cause of suffering. There's a cessation of suffering. There's a path leading to the cessation of suffering. The Buddha said, from his own experience, after he had meditated 6 years and performed these incredibly rigorous meditations, he said, I've discovered this truth. There is suffering. And I've also discovered that it's possible to end it. And so, after he had taught for 45 years in India, looking back on what he accomplished, he said, I've taught only two things, suffering and its end. Now, if you wanted to capture Buddhist doctrine as a whole, what you'd say and what you'd have to look at, and all that you'd have to look at, are those Four Noble Truths. Okay, so if we take them one by one now. There is suffering, dukkha, the Buddha said. He said, what constitutes suffering is almost anything we can imagine. Birth is suffering. Death is suffering. Aging is suffering. Old age is suffering. Pain, grief, lamentation is suffering. The second noble truth says there's a cause of suffering. There is desire, craving, and this is the most palpable cause of our suffering. But it's only the most palpable cause. We desire things to be permanent. We desire to get what we want. We desire to get away from what we don't want. And so that desire is one of the things that keeps samsara in motion. The root cause is our own ignorance about the way in which we exist and all other things exist. We try to hold on to something's being permanent, that is, by its nature, impermanent. that leads to frustration. So ignorance is the basic cause of suffering. The optimistic part about Buddhism is that after showing us various methods for eliminating the cause of suffering, it offers, in the Third Noble Truth, the end of suffering. And in Buddhist texts of the early school, that cessation is called nirvana. In teachings of the so-called later school, that end is called bodhi, or complete enlightenment. And this is the state that the Buddha himself attained. And attaining the cessation of suffering doesn't put someone in a different place, doesn't put them in a different body, doesn't put them in a different world. It changes their view. They give up the attachment to a self as a fixed, permanent existent. Changing that idea, giving up that idea, abandoning that idea, they find themselves with a new view of things. And that new view of the world is what nirvana is. It's not something else. It's not something apart from us. We have that potential within us to see it that way. If our ignorance is what causes suffering, then our own insight and our own wisdom is what will cause it to cease. So nirvana, as the Third Noble Truth, is held out as the possible end. It is an end to suffering, and such a thing exists. The Fourth Noble Truth says there is a path leading to the cessation of suffering. And that path provides a means for us to realize directly the end of suffering, so that you yourself can see, you know, try it on, try the method on, see whether it's beneficial or not. And if it is, then keep practicing. Now, this puts the responsibility for our practicing all of these various paths, but primarily the responsibility for gaining insight, right on our shoulders. It's not anywhere else. We have the ability to not only locate the cause, the root cause of suffering, but to eliminate it. We have that responsibility ourselves. It's not to be found in the outside world. It's not put in the hands of anyone else, any deity or any guru, any teacher. It is totally up to us. The Buddha himself said in a scripture that were it up to me, then samsara would be empty. If I could do it for you, samsara would be empty. But I can only show you the way. You yourself have to practice. You yourself have to try it out. You yourself have to investigate. You yourself have to sit on that cushion and meditate.
So in any case, the point is that when we think about liberation, we should not have the notion that it exists outside somewhere as a kind of a physical plane or physical domain. Rather, liberation has to be understood in terms of one's own quality of mind or state of mind. And we spoke about the presence of natural nirvana the natural purity in all of us, which serves as the basis. And on that basis, when all the obscurations and the afflictions are eliminated, that is the true nirvana, that's the true liberation. And when you go deeper in your understanding of the nature of liberation or moksha, then we can understand it in terms of the ultimate nature of one's own mind. The ultimate nature of one's own mind at a stage when all the afflictions are eliminated, that is the liberation, that is moksha. So we find that actually in the final analysis, it is our ignorance and fundamental misconception of the ultimate nature of reality that lies at the root of our samsaric existence, that lies at the root of our unenlightened existence. Therefore, if it is the ignorance and misconception of the fundamental nature of reality that creates the unenlightened existence, that means it is by cultivating the correct insight into the true nature of reality which will begin the process of undoing this unenlightened existence, which will begin the process of liberation. Therefore, as the Tibetan masters say, that when in ignorant state we are in the samsara, when insight or when the knowledge is developed, generated, then we are liberated. So this samsara and nirvana is distinguished on the basis of whether we are in the state of ignorance or whether we are in the state of knowledge. And so what we find here is that the ultimate antidote for eliminating fundamental ignorance, which is the root of cyclic existence, is the wisdom realizing emptiness, wisdom cognizing emptiness. And the emptiness, the ultimate nature of that mind, when all the obscurations have been eliminated, that emptiness of mind is the that quality of mind is the nirvana. That's the final nirvana. So therefore, we can say that that which causes us to be caught in unenlightened existence relates to our ignorance of the fundamental nature of reality, emptiness. So from the Buddhist point of view, this would be explained in terms of in the following way, that in the physical world there is an ever-present continuum at the subtlemost level of a physical continuum. We spoke about this earlier, which is space particles. And then when it interacts, comes into contact with sentient beings, karma acts as a condition, which then give rise to various permutations of the physical reality, so that eventually a macroscopic world comes into being that can actually have direct effect upon sentient beings' experience of pain and pleasure, happiness and suffering. So it is on these lines that the Buddhists would explain the whole evolution and dissolution of universe. This is very clear if you look at the traditional Buddhist teachings on the 12 links of dependent origination, which gives the picture of the process of evolution within the cycle of existence. We find that the individual's existence in cycle of existence, samsara, unenlightened existence, is explained in terms of this 12 interlocking chain. And here it is very clear that there is no concept of there being some kind of central unifying figure, which is like the kind of the creator of the everything, and then everything sort of revolves around it. Rather, the whole evolution is explained in terms of interlocking 12 sets of 12 chains. So the point of interlocking is that when, for example, one cycle of 12 links is in progress, before that entire cycle finishes, another cycle is already set in motion. So that while, for example, when you are already experiencing the consequences within one 12 chains, already ignorance and the karmic actions and so on, which is part of another cycle, is already set in motion. So in the teachings on the 12 links, the Buddha teaches us that the two sets of 12 links, a cycle of a chain of 12 links, one is the evolution within the evolution of an individual within the unenlightened existence, starting from ignorance, karmic volitional acts, consciousness, and so on. Then he also explains to us another cycle where the cycle is reversed, which then gives us the reversal process where the cycle, the process of enlightenment is explained. So by eliminating, by bringing to an end ignorance, then the volitional acts are prevented. By preventing volitional acts, consciousness is prevented, and so on. So the reversal process of unenlightened existence is also explained.
I think the 12 links is a fantastic teaching in terms of getting some fresh respect for the law of cause and effect. Because if you really think that each moment of ignorance is going to produce or will possibly produce a cause for one's next rebirth in samsara, that's pretty heavy. That's pretty scary. I found for myself that it definitely made me respect a little bit more my choices and my actions. And I think the other thing, of course, especially for Westerners, I think that the picture of the 12 links is kind of powerful, because of course it all begins, you know, the picture with a little old, usually it's a little old lady or a little old man with their stick, you know, because they're blind. And I think that's very challenging, because we like to think we're in control of our lives and that we're somehow this powerful, dynamic being walking through the landscape that we have chosen, making decisions, and, you know, we're in the driving seat and we're kind of successful at that. And then you see this picture, you think, I'm not that, that's some Tibetan thing, you know. And then, of course, when you really think about ignorance and how it's essentially leading us by the nose into this mud of harming ourselves and others and continued dissatisfaction, then yeah, we are pretty much like the little blind old lady, you know, tottering towards the precipice, completely unknowing what her steps are leading towards. So I think that it's a very helpful image that, again, the 12 links can really help you to see that that actually is a direct benefit that you are giving yourself and a direct benefit that you're giving to others, because every moment that you're consciously choosing not to act out of strong ignorance is a moment towards your enlightenment and a moment therefore to be able to benefit others. And every moment you think of that, of course, loosens that sense of I'm at the center of the world, you know, you exist for me. And it's like, well, no, I don't think that's true. And, you know, and actually I'm just, you know, existing independence upon other beings, independence upon causes and effects, independence, of course, upon this label, me. So I think that's another way in which we can really use the 12 links to give us not only a more enjoyable time in our daily life through remembering interdependence, but of course also, you know, trying to use that as a way to get closer to some understanding of selflessness and some, you know, because selflessness and interdependence are the two sides of the same coin, aren't they? So I think for all of those reasons, very helpful practice to try to reflect upon. In fact, I must do it more.
a poll? Sure. Okay.
And can, oh, thanks, Chris. I'm going to hit the lights back there. And so for, not to jump into a completely different thing, but I meant to do this earlier. I have a poll for the folks that have joined us on Zoom. It's a one question poll, and I'm going to launch it now. So for those of you that are on Zoom, if you guys can go ahead and answer this question. We just want to know why Zoom. So please share your decision for participating remotely instead of on-site in person here at the Canopus Center. And this is anonymous, so feel free to be honest. We just want to know.
We could also ask you all, why are you here in person? So that video summed up a whole lot of stuff that we're going to be talking about in this course. We'll get into greater detail about some of the things that that were mentioned. Should I just go on? Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
I could have guessed those results. So any questions from the video before we move on? And I want to also, at the end, I want to ask you if there's things that you definitely want to cover or questions that you have, because I can find answers. If I don't have them, I can ask Eshla for some help with things that you all definitely want to make sure we cover. So one of the things I wanted to say about Samsara Nirvana, this module, it is common to what we call the second scope or the middle scope. So there's three scopes, really like a camera, of teachings in this tradition. And the small scope is just narrowed in. It's really the gateway. So that first, and to go to the greater scope, you have to incorporate these first two scopes, right? So there's no just like jumping over, because they're all included in the final one. But the small scope is really like if you were in prison, and maybe you didn't know it. The prison cells are so nice, you know, but you want a nicer one. You'd like a nicer one. You like better food. You kind of are motivated now to take some classes and get better so that your time in prison is as good as possible. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, you need that. You need to have that desire to improve your lot. And so that's really the teachings in the first scope are about refuge, and we can talk about that later, but there's that whole set of teachings that's common to the first scope of improving and understanding your mind in order to improve your conditions as you're cycling through samsara. Then the second scope is to get out of prison. Oh my God, I really want to get out of prison. You know, I'm glad I had these nice cells and the food was better and I learned a whole lot and I really did improve myself. I got out of the gangs I was in. I got out of doing the things that were making my life miserable. I learned so much of what I was doing in prison that made it just hell. So then my prison life really improved. But now I really actually want to get out of prison. I see that I'm in prison. That's the second scope, is freeing of samsara, from the samsaric prison. So that's why the teachings and the meditations in this module are common to that second scope. And then the great scope includes the first two that we talked about, and I'm just giving you kind of almost like this cartoon character of what they are. But the great scope is the motivation and the teachings and the meditations on, I'm going to get out of prison so that I can figure out how to get everybody else out of prison. If I can get out of prison, I can, you know, blaze a trail that other people can follow, or I will have more information to be able to turn around and hold the door for everybody else. So, but you couldn't have that third scope teachings or motivation if you didn't understand the first two. So I hope from this video you also understood kind of what is samsara and what is nirvana. Did that become clear? You know, samsara is this whole cycle of existence that we just keep spinning around and uncontrollably going from a Buddhist perspective, you know, lifetime after lifetime on this wheel of reincarnation, kind of going up, going down, going up, going down, but not getting out. And nirvana then is the liberation from that state. And so what they're kind of getting at, and we'll go into a lot more of this over the weeks, but the causes of that, of staying on that merry-go-round, is our own mind, our own kind of afflicted thoughts, and our behavior, and our misunderstanding keeps that wheel spinning. And so the liberation then is from that mind state. So just like, again, if I'm in prison, there's a lot that I can do to change some of that myself. One of the key things to that is renunciation. And this is a word that I think we have a lot of misunderstandings about in the West, because I don't know, what comes to your mind when you first hear the word renunciation? Just throw anything out. It doesn't have to be right. Just what are some of your first things that come into your mind?
To give up everything.
To give up everything. Anything else? Vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. I mean, I, the visual image I have is someone sitting in a cave completely alone forever. That's a renunciant, right?
We've got deprivation.
Mm-hmm. So the definition that I found about renunciation is the aspiration wishing to attain freedom. The aspiration wishing to attain freedom. So you're in prison, and renunciation would be like, you know, again, imagine this is like samsara is this beautiful, it can be this very beautiful prison. You know, I have a nice cushion, I'm eating really well, things are going nice, I'm not in a war zone, it looks pretty good. Oh, I'm in prison, you know. So getting kind of woken up and creating that wish to get out, that's what they're saying renunciation is, because what will follow after that wish is what we're going to be talking about. But also I heard this one definition I have always loved a lot, which is renunciation is not going away from the world. It's knowing that the world goes away. It's not going away from the world. That would be, you know, a mistaken idea of also, can you really get away? not that easily. So it's not going away from the world. It's knowing that the world goes away. So when you know the world goes away, and you know things are impermanent, and that things are constantly shifting, it seems like it changes, and it can change your relationship to them. So a good example I like to use is when we go to hotel rooms. We're not expecting to stay. We're not upset when we leave. You know, we know this is a 1 or 2 day stay. We kind of enjoy the room, kick back, turn on the TV, get some food, whatever. We're enjoying that moment of what we have in that hotel room. We're not holding on too tightly to it. We know it goes away. We know it goes away. Nothing wrong with enjoying and being happy, but we don't cling to it because we know that it goes away. So similarly, in samsara, if we have developed this renunciation that we know the world goes away, then we're relating to it very differently. I've told some of you have heard this story before, but it just really, to me, helped me understand this and so much more, because there's little dharma lessons all around us. So my mother years ago was in an assisted living facility, and she was kind of worse off than a lot of the people there. And some of the people at her table where she ate every day were so kind. They helped feed her because she couldn't really manipulate the silverware. And I was watching this, and I was telling the nurse, you know, these people are so kind. And she said, well, the people who are here who know why they're here, in other words, they know they have some illness or whatever, the people who know why they're here turn around and help the other people. And to me, that was just such a little nugget of samsara. So those of us who know we're here, we're in this together, we're in samsara, we're not in, you know, this fantastic pure land that sometimes it appears to be, that we're in this realm of samsara and we know it, that to me generates immediately kindness towards others, because we're all stuck in this together. Right? And actually turning around and being kinder to other people and helping them through this is part of my way out. it's going to generate some of the causes to get out. But think, you know, what I'd love for you to do is come up and see if you think of things like that this week, examples that you can share, examples in your own life of the prison that we're in, of renunciation, and just some little stories like that, because it's from our daily life that these things make sense. And these things need to be meaningful and practical in our daily life for them to really get in our kind of our bloodstream. So part of this then, part of getting out of prison, part of renunciation is really understanding suffering, which is a drag. You know, it's like Buddha had a really difficult job because he had to talk to people about, hey, we're going to talk about suffering. But it's more like an analyst. It's more like really understanding what it is, because it can appear in so many different guises and it can trick us. And so we can forget that we can use it, just like everything can be the cause of suffering, everything can also be the cause of getting out of prison. So we can use everything. So this is when they were talking about the three kinds of suffering. Did that make sense to you all? It's like, say I walk 10 miles to get here. I would be really tired. I probably wouldn't make it. I'd be really tired. And I would be suffering the sufferings of suffering. That's the first thing, is the suffering of suffering. We all know that. We all, you know, understand that. We have a pain, we have a difficulty, whatever. I'm tired from walking 10 miles. That's the suffering of suffering. Then I sit down and some of those pains go away and I feel happy. I feel the relief. But that's also a kind of suffering. They call that the suffering of change. So because things change means that they're not steady and stagnant and reliable. Not stagnant, but steady and reliable. So now I've sat down and I've relieved the pain that was in my legs and I've had some water, and so my immediate suffering has been relieved and I feel happy. But if I sit here too long, I'm now going to go back to the suffering of suffering. So the suffering of change, which brought me some happiness and relieved my suffering, can turn back into number one. So I just go back and forth between those. You know, like, oh, it's too hot in here. Oh, wait, now it's too cold in here. Oh, wait, it's too hot in here. And so we just keep, you know, we're trying to find that middle balance. I mean, we're all doing that. It's part of this life. Then the third one is the pervasive suffering. And that's really more about like why we even have any of these sufferings. It's a little more complicated, because it's, even when things are equal and easy peasy and we find some equanimity, there's these other two sufferings just right around us all the time. They haven't gone away, right? So I haven't sat here too long. I haven't been walking 10 miles. I feel pretty good, but that could change at any minute. And why? Because I'm in samsara. And why am I in samsara? And so it goes on and on like that. But basically, I have this, what we call aggregates. I have certain things that make me up, so that we can say, this is me. And all of those things together create this potential for all this suffering. So it gets really complicated, and we're not going to go there right now. But all the stuff that we're going to be covering was in that video about the 12 links of dependent origination. How do we keep spinning through this? What are the things we can do to get out? There are real concrete things that we can do. It's doesn't have to be so esoteric. There are things that we can do, and that's what we're going to be talking about, is some real concrete things. So you've all probably heard about the Four Noble Truths. And, you know, what I love about Buddhism is it's kind of like those accordion files. You know, you can open it, you can just hold it, you can pull it all together and go, okay, I got my Four Noble Truths. Or you can open it up and keep on opening it and opening it and opening it and opening it, right? So this class is kind of, you know, it's compact. But so almost everything we're going to talk about are in some of these lists, especially the Four Noble Truths. And the first one is the noble truth of suffering. Go suffering. but just realizing we're in prison isn't enough. Just realizing we're in prison isn't enough. So you can see, suffering kind of got blurred there, which is not so bad. So then the second noble truth is the causes of suffering. Understanding the noble truth of the causes of suffering. Because it's if it was enough just to understand that suffering could be stopped, then why wouldn't we just jump to number three? Oh, there's suffering, there's prison, there's a way out of prison. But the causes are going to lead you to the cessation. So I'm going to give you this example I was thinking of today on the way here. How many people have seen The Miracle Worker, about Helen Keller's life? Okay, yeah, we're kind of old, right? Watch it if you get a chance to watch it, right? How many people have, anybody not heard of Helen Keller? Okay, good. All right, so in this movie, you see her life and you see her breakthrough and the challenges her teacher had. And I'm going to show her in these Four Noble Truths. And the bulk of the movie is her understanding the first one, that, oh, I'm all alone, I can't communicate with anybody. That kind of suffering that she was experiencing, being cut off and isolated, she really didn't know, you know. So the whole movie is really that teacher breaking through to that understanding that of that suffering. Then immediately after understanding that first noble truth was not the cause of her disability, but what's the cause of my isolation, of my disconnect from people, is I don't know the names of all these things. I can't communicate. That's the cause. And so then immediately upon that one, there was the understanding that that could be rectified, that could be changed, that that cause of her isolation could cease, could end. And then the rest of her, the rest of the, we didn't go on in the movie, but then the next step was clearly the remedy that to be applied, the path that she needed to learn all these words. And so at the end, you see her asking everything. Now that she's understood there's a name for water, that's what the teacher starts trying to really drill into her, that this is water, there's a name for it. And she would sign it into her hand. And she slowly, but it took a long time, began to understand what this teacher was trying to tell her, that this is water, it has a name. And so then once that whole breakthrough happened, which I'm just describing, then she immediately started touching everything and wanting names for them. And that was the path out of that suffering that I'm describing in this analogy. And so another way of looking at it is, what is to be known? What is to be abandoned? So for her, what is to be known is that there are names for things. There's ways to communicate. She didn't know that. She was just in her own dark bubble of blindness, deafness, inability to communicate. So what is to be known for her was, there's ways to communicate. There's names for things. So what is to be abandoned then? In her case, it was the ignorance of those names. What is to be experienced, right? The cessation of the problems. And then what's to be relied upon? There's lots of different ways of looking at it. But it's not enough just to want to be free of problems. Most of us, we can get there, even though it's a lot harder. If you woke up in a prison cell every day, you would not have to generate the wish to get out. If you're in a war zone, you don't have to generate the wish for this to be over. But because when our lives are pretty comfortable, we often have to work hard to generate that wish. And that's okay. Generate it. But that's not enough. We have to understand then what's causing this. What's causing me to be in this realm that even if my life is really good, 70% of my life, chances are I'm going to come back to just continue. And it could be worse. I'm not guaranteed a better prison cell next time. You know, I'm not guaranteed. Right now, I have really great conditions. I'm getting all these classes in my prison and really good food, and I have good conditions in my prison cell to take the next step. And so then the next step is to understand what's causing me to be here. And then the next step is to, try to to get out, and what do I need to rely on to get out? And understanding the causes, like I gave with the Helen Keller, generates the next step. That's how I kind of understand this. And so that's why also that, you know, in a lot of analogies, Buddha is considered like the doctor with the medicine, right? And the Dharma is the medicine. And all the Sangha are the nurses or the physician assistants. All right. We've gone over that. Okay, good. So some of the things we'll be doing in the class, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism is famous for all these lists of things. And certainly when we're looking at samsara nirvana, we're going to look at negative mind states that keep us here. Because one of the things you saw in the film is this is creating causes to change is in your hands. And what is it that we're changing? It's our mind state. And it sounds easy. It's obviously not that easy, but I remember reading something Thich Nhat Hanh said, which is that, everybody, you know, wants to stop the world and do all these kinds of amazing things in meditation. He said, you know what's the real miracle? Is changing your mood. If you can change your mood, that's a freaking miracle. And so what I would suggest you all do for homework is to think of a mood that you want to change. What's a mood that you're sick of? I mean, none of us run around like, I can't wait till the next time I get jealous. Or I can't wait to get angry. It feels so good. No. So what's a mood? And I would suggest, you know, so think of that mood. You know, anger is a pretty common one. You know, we lose our patience or we're irritated. Think of a mood that you personally are tired of and that you would like to change. And then identify when you see the triggers for it, the small rumblings of it, not when it's at 10. Okay, we're not going to have, if I were to ask you what makes someone succeed in anything, you know, think about that. What makes someone succeed in anything they're trying? I thought a lot about it because I work with, as a mediator in very difficult disputes. And I tried to break it down because I felt like the answer to that question is success. What makes somebody change is guaranteed success. If you were going to teach me piano, you would not start with something complicated. You would just help me understand how to play simple scale, where my fingers go. So when you're trying to change your mood, I want you to have guaranteed success, 100%. I don't want you to try the Super Bowl. I want you to just pick up a football and toss it in the air and catch it. So think of this mood that you want to change. Think of a time that you could definitely win. A really small example. So, you know, Geshe-la, when he first came to this country, he was giving us the teaching on patience. And what he was saying is, you know, we have to expand our patience the way that after you've been sick and your stomach has shrunk because you haven't eaten much, you know, you get so full so quickly. You can't just eat a large meal. You would have to slowly expand your stomach. So same thing with our ability to be patient. So we were meditating a lot on the advantages of patience and the disadvantages of anger or losing our patience. And I got so excited. I was like, I can't wait to try and expand my patience. So that night, my dog woke me up to go out and pee. And, you know, first time, no problem. Second time, I was like getting a little annoyed. I thought, I was so excited. I was like, here's my chance to practice. And when I went outside with her, I was actually really thrilled because I knew that, like, if I lost my patience, it was going to make this whole thing worse. You know, she would pick up my vibe. I would have a harder time getting back to sleep. The event had already happened. She'd already woken me up, right? So I went out with a really calm mind state. I was just looking up at the stars and making wishes, walking back inside, and went back to sleep, no problem. So find a way like that. It's something achievable. Think of something achievable that you can do and take one step that you know you're going to have some guaranteed success. And then give yourself, like, what would be the second level? So even going, say it's like you're going to go, you have to go to the post office, there's going to be a long line of people and we're all spread out all over the place. I think that's going to be my first place to try it, you know. And if you go into it knowing that, then it won't kind of sneak up and catch you by surprise. So you can build on that. That's what we want to do, is just build on these things. And you're the only one who can identify what it is that you want to change. You know, what are some mind states that you want to change? And so the negative mind states, the afflicted emotions that we're generally, the general categories of those, in case you're interested, are anger, attachment, which I like to think, when I say the word attachment, I change it in my head to grasping, because there are lots of positive attachments in this world. And because the way that we use it in the West a lot, you know, we talk about attachment theory and when children have a hard time attaching and so on and so forth. So I think it gets complicated. I just translate that in my head to grasping. That's the real problem, right? Pride, ignorance, like our blind spots, you know, what are our blind spots? And doubt, and they mean like really contaminated doubt, where especially around ways out of prison. You know, you just have this real contaminated doubt. We'll talk more about that. But also wrong view. And wrong view, there's lots of different categories of wrong view, but in general, it would be the view that I exist just exactly how I imagine, that I am this solid, separate entity that exists permanently. So we all have these things. So what we're going to do is kind of like chip away at some of them so that we can start to see what that looks like. What does it look like? And we're going to talk about the antidotes to that. What does it look like to apply the antidote to anger, which is patience, which is love? And so this is why it's hard to apply these things when they're full blown, right? It's easier to try to expand the antidotes, to try to expand your patience so that you have this counterweight to the side of us that has the anger. That makes sense? So the same thing with wrong view. It's easier to try to expand our understanding of what is reality? How do things exist? So that we can lean into that. We need to have bigger pockets of what we lean into rather than just trying to quash what we don't like. All right, so right on time, because we're ending at 8, think about if any of y'all have questions, see your notes. Okay, can you see the notes? People want to see the notes on Zoom. Where did you... I said them.
Sorry, Steve. I think that was for if this chat is up here, you can see what people are chatting.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. I got to check that out more.
That's okay.
If anybody needs to get in touch with me, I can't promise I'll write you back right away because I also work a lot, but especially if you're new and you're confused, my email address is steep, like a steep hill. Smith, that's all one word, steepsmith@gmail.com. And put in the title something about DB, that's Discovering Buddhism, so I can check that out. And so now we're going to dedicate the merit that we created. So the idea behind that is that, you know, the tools that we have to get out of the prison are our body, our speech, and our mind. That through our body, our speech, and our mind, we create energy, we create seeds for our future, and that by coming to class, by coming onto Zoom, we have created a lot of positive seeds by just trying to get our head around this. It took effort to come here today or to get on Zoom and participate. So take a minute to think about all that energy that you've created. And now you can actually, just like money, I mean, you created something, you can dedicate it. You can dedicate it to people in your life. So I would say, let's first dedicate it to whatever problems you're dealing with. anything in your life that you're having a hard time with, start with yourself, be self-compassionate, and hope that these things that you're struggling with are easier. And then imagine people in your life that you know and care about, and how you would want them to be happier than they currently are and have less problems. And then think about people you don't know all around the world, all kinds of beings who are struggling with various problems, and how you would wish that they would be relieved of these problems. And then the more challenging one, of think of people that you don't care for too much, that you would wish that they would also be free. Some of the negative mind states that we've been talking about. And ultimately dedicate this so that you can achieve the great scope that we were talking about, that you can find your way out of this samsaric existence in order to help everyone else do the same. Thank you. And hope to see you next week. Donna, do you have an announcement or something? No. Okay.
Forget it. I don't need to stand up. A quick announcement. So Geshe Sangpo, one of our resident monks here at the Kadampa Center, has written a book. We had a launch event last weekend. It is called Opening the Door to Happiness. Oh, here. Actually, let me remove the spotlight here. Put it on me. Okay. Okay. So, Opening the Door to Happiness by Geshe Sangpo. And for those of you who are on site here, there are free copies out in the lobby, so be sure to pick one of those up. Those of you who are on Zoom, maybe you can stop by someday and grab a copy. And also, there are some free Kadampa Center coffee mugs out in the lobby as well. And again, I want to thank everyone, whether you are participating on site, yay, or on Zoom or on YouTube. Thank you so much. I feel like tonight went really well. hopefully you do too. And thank you for all the volunteers. We've got Chris and Jen and Aaron, who's done so much. And Steve, thank you for your teaching. The homework will be posted on the Discovering Buddhism materials site. Access that there. It'll be later on tonight. Feel free to email either me or Steve questions if you have any, and we will address those in the coming weeks. All right. Thanks, everyone. It's good to see you all.